So what happened when you got to the 900 foot level?
February 3rd, 2023.
Well, it did, in fact, this is part 8
of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Donald spells his last name D-A-V-I-S. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Donald. How are you today? Okay, good. Donald, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone? Thank you. You mentioned just now a small recollection of Harvey Butchert, B-U-T-C-H-A-R-T. Would you mind to recount that?
From that junction to the west and to the east and to the southwest and the
It happened that Harvey played chess, and I was also playing chess at that time, so we had two games of chess, and I actually won one of them myself.
What did Ron Curbo think about all this? Was he pretty happy the whole thing was going this way?
The game, and was quite surprised to win even one game against a professor of mathematics.
And how did Harvey take it?
Good.
Calmly enough. He didn't smash the board and swing things around.
Okay. And his wife, Roma, R-O-M-A, did she say anything? Yeah, you guys had broken apart, but Dave would have been interesting to see three other people, Rick Bridges and Don Patterson and one other, and so Dave had just kind of walked away from the whole deal.
Not have insulted you,
but as you guys started commending and discovering this massive new world, you must have been, I'm assuming, reporting back to Ron, I would assume that Ron was reporting back to his people in the park.
I think she liked bridge, though.
They were,
Anyway,
but also
we had talked about trip you did to Rampart Cave in Western Grand Canyon in 1974. Could you go back to that time and see what you remember from that?
I remember quite a lot from that because it was a very eventful trip for me.
Wait a minute, he was in a national park.
Yes. We thought Rick, you're going someplace to see overkill this explanation of the Park Service,
the disappearance, and maybe fauna.
He exemplified something
that one of the few general trips intermittently that I learned in the Rampart Cave, primarily in the far western Grand Canyon,
was a small cave, no more than 300 feet or so of passage.
Knowing where the dimensions of that passage, and somehow I had found out that Paul Martin was planning a trip to that area. I was especially interested.
What did the Park Service do?
Before that, ultimately, I'd been interested in Bat Cave on the north side of the canyon. In that far west region, came up as Rampart Cave. I knew that it had been used for
also working trying to
quite a few years
as a project that would get an
exotic mine, but it had a population of just what they wanted us to do. And
I believe we came back in as a reorganized,
much detailed
project,
maps,
and resumed
mapping
with the northwestern most population of them. As a matter of fact,
when did the resuming of the mapping begin? Do you remember roughly the dates for that?
Tramway all the way across the canyon.
Okay. So the MPS came up with a better plan, and then reopened it.
I think we sort of think that agreed on obviously large cave.
Okay, so the MPS and the cavers.
No others were reported to me.
I've got another thing going on right now, so I'm going to need to wrap this interview up. But when we come back, we can pick up what happened then, when y'all came back in for what would be the third go-round of Lechuguilla. Does that sound right?
Okay.
So this will conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Today is February 3rd, 2023. It's Friday. My name is Tom Martin. And Donald, thank you so very, very much. This has been a very, very engaging, very fascinating interview. Do you remember who from CSU was going?
I'm not without reference to my letters, anyway.
Okay.
There isn't much to be found in my published material, in my material that NAU has about that cave, because the discoveries I made in there, I did not wish to publicize, I'm being more frank with this now than I would have been early on, for one reason, but the cave is harder to access because it once had a ladder going up into it, about 100 feet long. But also because it's part of the national park now. I don't think it was yet at that.
That's
time.
Right. In 1974. Do you remember? So you got a ride possibly out from CSU. Was there a boat that took you from Pierce Ferry up to the Columbine Falls Rampart Cave area, or did you have to walk up there?
Walking up there was essentially a non-starter. It was too many miles. I mean, yes, we had a boat from Pierce Ferry. We might have had more than one watercraft. I'm not really sure. But
okay.
We did go up the reservoir, the water. At that time was high enough that it was slack water for that entire distance. In fact, as far up as about Burnt Canyon. So travel in that end of the canyon, if you had a boat, it could be quite easy. First we did visit Rampart Cave, and I was quite bemused by my massive amounts of sloth guano that occupied this small but very dry, warm cave. And it had a trench running along the middle. I think this was excavated by a paleontologist. And on either side, there were these masses of what looked like a size and a half horse dung pellets that were laid there by a Pleistocene sloths. And that in itself was quite an awe-inspiring thing to contemplate, that you were amidst the production of these extinct animals. And Paul Martin also took us around. He and I were not, and the Colorado Man were not the only people. There were others associated more directly with Paul Martin, I think, that we had maybe half a dozen people all together. And he took us around to the east and south to a smaller cave known as Rampart Cave, which had rat guano deposits, pack rat.
Sorry, was that Vulture Cave?
I'm sorry, yes, Vulture Cave.
Thank you.
Rampart was the first one. I'm glad you corrected that. So he explained how that these rather thick deposits of pack rat guano had been radiocarbon dated at close to 50,000 years, if I remember correctly.
Oh, that would have run off the rails of radiocarbon dating.
Yeah,
wow, pretty neat.
Near the limits of the method, yes.
Huh.
So, let's see.
And were you camping at the waterfall there at Columbine Falls or up on the flats, the kind of flat creosote?
I think we were actually near Columbine Falls, probably getting water from it, as I recall.
Okay.
And it turned out I had explained my interest in getting to look at Bat Cave, but only I expressed any interest in it when I brought it up, but the one man was planning to run the motorboat up farther in the canyon. I forget what his errand was intended to be up there.
Could he have been a National Park Service ranger that would go ahead and continue a patrol up that way in a Park Service boat?
No, I think this was before the Park Service was running boats, or was I? Well,
it would have been a Lake Mead, yeah. A Lake Mead ranger, doing
no,
patrol up that way.
Okay. I'm pretty sure it was not a Lake Mead staff person, but rather one of the researchers.
Oh, okay.
And so he told me, well, he could take me up there if I was willing to do a solo check up into the cave area. He would let me off on the river flat below, or 750 feet below the cave, and go farther up river, do what he was doing, and come back at 3 p.m. And he strongly advised me to be there. I don't want to be late waiting for you. And
what time did he drop you off?
On the Bat Cave side, the north side.
Well, no. What was it, like 8 in the morning, and you had till 3?
Oh, no, it wasn't that early. I don't remember.
Okay.
I would say mid-morning or some such time.
So maybe 10-ish, so you had like 5 hours.
Yes, I hadn't a great deal of time for this trip, and I certainly didn't want to run any risk of being stranded on the bank of Lake Mead.
Right.
So I was in good condition then, and I hiked as hard and fast as I could up the obvious route up, up into the Moa of Limestone. And this is one unusual thing about Bat Cave, is that the cave is in the Moa of Limestone, which is common enough in the Western Canyon, but only for the stream caves that are near the present base level. And the caves there have been made to develop just above the Bright Angel Shale.
Hmm.
But here in the western end of the canyon, you had apparently a large cave, dry cave, in the Moa of Limestone heading northward into the rim there. And so I hiked up as fast as I could get there and was able to climb the 100-foot ladder with no incident. And when I got to the top, I found a large gallery heading in that had catwalk bridges, wooden 10-foot or so, 10-inch size beam running across the entry zone of the cave, so to make it easier to avoid ups and downs in the floor below. And I was able to cross those without losing my balance. You could fall 10, 20, 30 feet off there, and then walk through the guano zone, which still had lots of it in there. They had stopped mining it several years earlier. But I kept going. You had to climb a mountain of bat guano and then continue. And gradually the cave narrowed, but still quite large passage. And iguana thinned out until I came to an intersection in there where there were just short hints of continuing passage everywhere but to the right. And if I went to the right, there was a 70-degree angle change in the passage orientation. I went over there a couple or 300 feet, I think, and hit another junction, and the biggest passage continued north from that junction. This was pretty well clear outside the guano deposit zone at that point. So I went down east, and I was wrong. It was a relatively short north trend at that point, I believe, and the main part, the biggest, most interesting looking, went down easterly and came to another junction where there was a big northerly trend going. But as I started heading that way, I noticed a small opening down on the right side of the breakdown floor, and went or dropped down to check that out. And I noticed a strong draft of air reversing every 45 seconds. I timed it for a while, and a strong airflow like that, especially in a cave when you don't know any reason for it to have any other entrance, is an extremely good sign of ongoing cave that may be quite large. So it went down to a low point and came back up and then hit another junction. And I noticed that at the bottom of the low point, I encountered one previous set of footprints. No idea whose they might have been, but they were quite clear in the light dust from the floor at that point. And so I kept going in that direction, and I ran out of footprints when the thing began to go back up in an easterly direction. I realized I'm exploring new passage here. During all this time when they were mining guano, not one person bothered to go that far into the cave.
Huh.
But what was more remarkable, I began to encounter spectacular evaporite decorations, gypsum, evidently, of which spears and flowers were growing 2 feet out into the passage from the walls, and just incredibly spectacular and vulnerable material. And this was also very warm, about, I think, 72 degrees. And I had a thermometer with me and took readings, and I was literally caving in a T-shirt and yet sweating like a pig, just moving fast through all this. So when it began to get a little harder going, I decided, well, I'm short on time, so I better turn around. And in the process of doing that, in crossing the first northward trend, which was actually a bigger gallery, I went a few hundred feet along there, and it just kept going gigantically, possibly 70, 80 feet high on the average. And I just kept getting more and more mind blown, but I knew that I was running short on my allotted time, so I just turned out and retraced my route all the way back to the entrance and out, and was able to hasten down. And I got down just about at 3, and he got there just about at 3.
Donald, I wanted to ask you, you shared a link the other day of some cavers mapping and exploring in a cave called Double Bopper.
Yes.
And that cave has the gypsum decorations. Just fascinating things. Was that similar to what you saw?
Not really in detail. It had more sphere-like things in it. In that cave, or as I think, what I've seen, the pictures from Double Whopper Cave, it's more gypsum flowers in there.
But I just find it fascinating. Actually, both of them are...
You know, I just told you something wrong. I was saying gypsum. I should have said aragonite.
Oh.
Because most of it was aragonite rather than gypsum. My mind is not that great at retrieval right now, but I just realized I'd been telling you a mistake on the identity of the decoration.
No worries, you figured it out and corrected it, and that's fine.
Well, I'm pretty sure I did anyway.
It just makes me wonder about, you know, I think of Grand Canyon, and I think of Tepetz Creek Cave and Deer Creek Cave and the Shinumu Caves and the wet caves with water in them. And yet there are these other caves that don't have a lot of water, if any, in them. But they do have these amazing evaporite-type materials where the concentration of the material is so high in the air that over time you can actually form crystals away from the wall that are 6 inches to a foot or more long. As the minerals are concentrating out of the air.
They're not actually concentrating. Well, the minerals are not delivered in the atmosphere.
Oh.
They are delivered from the cave wall and the ceiling. But the atmospheric part of it is the strong evaporation capacity that it produces.
Oh, okay, so there should be some water then on the side of the cave wall when these were formed.
Or in the pores of the rock, really, with a slight gradient between the humidity inside the wall pores and in the cave atmosphere, then there will be very slow seepage outward, and as soon as the dissolved material gets to the wall of the cave, and the evaporation causes precipitation.
Okay. Yeah, it's just amazing how long it takes. And I mean, it's not, you look at the walls, they don't look particularly wet. So how that happens is really fascinating.
I think we'll be saying more about Lechuguilla Cave in a while. And it has gypsum decorations up to 20 feet long.
Wow.
Those are crystalline selenite and world-class massive stuff. And some of those can have drips of water on the crystals.
Oh.
So that's the only way they could get to be that long. The water has to be able to make it 20 feet down without depositing and completely evaporating.
Amazing. Okay.
But the Grand Canyon certainly has its own world-class evaporative decoration. And so in that cave, I was in a very agitated state of mind, but I realized that this stuff is exceedingly vulnerable to mineral collectors. They have these sales fairs and the like, selling crystals, and if the people in Las Vegas knew what there was in the inner bat cave, they might go berserk and take their jet boats up like Mead very easily and get back there and begin to raid the cave for sale. And I was absolutely unwilling to try or to contribute to such a thing. So I was afraid that since we had people, I think, on the trip who might be connected to that area, that I did not dare talk about it to the people I'd gone there with, and I just kept my mouth shut. I just generalized about the cave having been very interesting, and I didn't tell people any more detail at that point. All that time I was really, I would have been really eager to talk about it, but I had to be really careful to whom I did talk about it. And so we went back to camp, the trip broke up, and we all went our various ways, but I knew that I had to get my caving partners involved in this so that we could actually find out how far the cave went and what it did.
Right.
And Louise Hose, who presently is a geologist, a professor in Nevada, that was the primary other person in my connection. In fact, I think I'd introduced her and her then husband, Tom Strong, to the Grand Canyon in 1984 when we did the Esplanade south of Powell Plateau. And they were able to handle that, so we began doing other things, and especially on the Wallapai Reservation, where we were able to get permission from the Indians at that time to make visits to the Red Wall Rim in their reservation. And we'd made a number of trips in that area in the 70s and discovered one cave that we surveyed 3 miles of passage.
Wow.
And passage in, and at that time that was on a par with Falls Cave in Marble Gorge as the longest known caves surveyed in the canyon. That was a maze, which might be an extremely old cave. It also had very spectacular gypsum decoration in it. So we began to extend our operation into Lake Mead, which was still a water level that made it easy to get up canyon, but we didn't have any inflatable, or rather any motorized boats, but we had access to inflatable rafts. So we would go to Pierce Ferry and start from there. And the big advantage of having rafts over hiking in with backpacks is you can carry hugely more gear with you, more food, more water, and more exploration gear, rope, and all. So we were just rowing up canyon to that cave and setting up camp there. And we made several trips extending the cave greatly. We ended up surveying almost the entire cave, although one final passage or two ended up being surveyed much later after the park had been informed about the cave.
And do you remember how extensive it is?
It is, I think, if I remember correctly, something like a mile and a half total.
Okay.
I could be mistaken, but I can check well enough because I have the raw data in a cave mapping program, and I can reestablish exactly how long the survey ended up being. But it was quite respectable, and it just kept getting better. The long gallery went back to the north until it suddenly struck a collapse. The ceiling had dropped a couple of huge boulders and some smaller material down there, and it faced us with a 20-foot cliff. And underneath, you could see through into something but it was a very tight crawl among large wedge drake down boulders, which scared us. The last thing we wanted to do was crawl into there and dislodge an unstable rock over us and get crushed. But we remembered something that in that part of the cave, there had been a 20-foot section of antenna tower, the kind that's made in triangular shape out of tubing.
Yep.
With bracing in between. It was 2 10-foot segments long, 20 feet long, and it looked like just what we could use to get over this obstacle if we could get it back there. And it was, I'd say, more than 1,000 feet of passage.
Wow.
And not all simple walking getting it back there. And at one point, we had to turn a sharp corner without grazing the vulnerable features up the corners of the cave there.
Oh, my gosh.
We succeeded, actually, just Varg Nelson and myself were taking it back through here. So we erected it on the buttress below the collapse and attached a rope to the end of it. I think that's how we did it, rather than directly climbing the device. And we climbed the rope, and it got us just to the top. And then we had to rope down the far side. But then the huge gallery kept going another 100 yards or so into a still bigger, huge, wide room that had 3 visible passages leading from the far side of it. And all of this stuff on that far side just literally sheathed in this aragonite and
Propolis
gypsum, I think, materials up to several feet in length. So we ended up having to make a single trail path just to even get through there. And even then we did some damage, but we succeeded in surveying the cave. And those 3 passages, and the 2 of them to the west, didn't go that much farther, but to the east, the cave continued in rather smaller dimensions, though still big enough. And at one point on the floor there, we found an ancient animal skeleton that appeared to belong to a ringtail, had a carnivorous skull, and the size was about right. And it was old enough that gypsum material had grown white spears up several inches through the bones of the ribs.
Wow.
I had a photograph of that, but I don't know where it is today. In fact, I'm not sure where the photography ended up in all of our activities there. Louise Hose actually might have it. So in any case, that was extremely rewarding. That had been my most intriguing Grand Canyon discovery up till that time.
Fascinating. And Unu, I went in there. I never went back any further than the Gowanus one. Never looking around there. So,
Yes.
Amazing.
I had some reason to suspect that that single set of footprints that I'd seen before they ended might have been from George Beck, because I'd heard he'd spent some time in that area. And we also found another cave just a few hundred feet to the east that was several hundred feet in large passage that I named Black Vault Cave because it had an unusually dark walls, I think, and it appeared to have been a disconnected segment of the Bat Cave complex But it didn't go farther than that.
Hmm.
But also Burnt Canyon upstream from there was intriguing as well. We were able to get our rafts up into that area and especially check out the East Arm where there were rumors of a cave. And we found that there was, in fact, one cave off to the north side of the East Arm of Burnt Canyon, a few hundred feet of passage, or rather interesting, but minor compared with Bat Cave. And at the upper end of that, the base of the Red Wall was encountered, and one arm goes up to the east, so I tried to climb as far up into that as possible. And it turned out that it became impassable at the head, but there had been a paleo cave developed in the lower Red Wall at that point, a passage about 6 by 3 feet dimensions, which was completely stuffed with lava, basalt, intrusive volcanic lava, magma, I should say. And it had been lined before that with subaqueous calcite, which had then apparently been invaded by this volcanic eruption, which had made a pair of dikes, if I remember correctly, in what ought to have been the way out of that arm if it had not been so vertical. So that was geologically fascinating. You don't encounter an interaction between limestone solution cave and volcanic magma.
Right.
Very commonly. And there was an interesting buttress on the south side of Burnt Canyon, a Red Wall block, that I'd seen a big cave entrance from the river as we went up in that area. And I wanted to see if I could get to the rim there and get over that cave. But the only feasible route that I could find was just too much for me. I was not able to, daring enough to get up through there. And for some reason, I was solo at that point. And so, but in the process of getting there, I had gone along, I'd gone to the head of the East Arm and then back along the base of the Red Wall Cliff. And in doing so, I came to a big overhang that had had dripping water. I think there was still seepage going from the edge. And it had grown these stalactiform formations sticking out at an angle from the edge of the overhang of the ceiling, spectacular decorations in their own right. And in the twilight still of the cliff base, and in from this and behind the sort of rampart along the outer edge are these incredible growths of, I think it was Nolina. I need to refer to my article, or not article, but log of this trip to be sure about that. But the whole thing was highly scenic, and I had nothing to photograph it with, but it was one of the real beauty spots of the entire Grand Canyon, like the little hidden places that people rave about in places like Elves Chasm. And this was on that level of spectacle. But as far as I knew, no one else other than the Indians had ever been there. So that was a rewarding discovery in its own right that I didn't share widely. I didn't want it to get trampled.
I forgot to ask you, did you get a chance to explore Chiava Cave?
Would you repeat that? I didn't catch that.
I wondered if you'd had a chance to explore Chiava Cave up in the Clear Creek drainage.
I'd been well aware of it since the Coal Brothers had gotten to it in the early 1900s.
Right.
I wanted to eventually, but my first actual visit to where I could see the cave was with some of those Cave Research Associates people who had rejected my collaboration with them. But I was able to go across the canyon on one of the trips when they were visiting the Chiava Falls, and I looked across and watched them and the little human figures on the huge cliff. And I think it was Huntoon, in fact, who was the friendliest of them with me. I mean, we were watching the others explore, but I didn't get any opportunity to go back there then, and I didn't get to do that until almost the end of my caving at the canyon. And we came in from the north rim in the late fall, and I was going to try to see if I could still handle the effort involved in getting down there. They were just going more or less rappelling all the cliffs going down, which the Cave Research Associates had not done it that way. They'd done the traverses along the Supai until they were above the cave. But in any case, I think this was in the 90s, but again, I need to recheck things on that. But I was already getting considerably weaker than I used to be, and I started down with them, but I had 3 gallons of water. I didn't know if we would be stuck on the ledges on the way down, and I didn't want to be too short on water. And by the time I reached the Coconino, I realized I can't do this anymore. It's not safe. I won't be able to manage it. And I told the other three that, no, I'm not fit for it any longer. You guys go ahead and spend your full time down there. I'll go back to the trucks on the rim and wait for you. And yes, I did that, and then they got down and did their survey and did a very nice map of Chiava Falls Cave, whereas I was fighting boredom for 3 days, and a snowstorm came in, and it snowed 6 inches, and I was really getting pretty claustrophobic by that point. And but they came back up with the trip successful, but we could not get out. There was too much snow on the highway. But luckily, we were able to get in touch by radio with the North Rim station saying that we were stranded, and so they had to come out with a snowplow and literally rescue the last people on the North Rim Highway that year. So that was quite an adventure, but it was the beginning of, or the culmination of, the end of my Grand Canyon activities. I just had gotten too weak to handle it.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was about the big caves in New Mexico near Carlsbad, specifically Lechuguilla.
Lechuguilla Cave.
Yeah.
Yes. That was a wonderful discovery. It started out as a small cave in Carlsbad Caverns National Park, 4.5 miles west-northwest of Carlsbad Cavern. It had been visited around World War I and prospected as a potential guano mine. There was some bat guano down there. There was a rope drop down to that level of the original cave, which from that point it went in only about 100 yards, but the bat guano didn't turn out to be profitable, although a guano hopper and a few other relics had been left there, which the Park Service took away ultimately and put in storage. But there was this extremely interesting wind from the breakdown and a level farther below the guano level. And are you hearing me okay?
Yes.
And the Cave Research Foundation, which is different from Cave Research Associates, had a branch at Carlsbad, and in the late 70s they went there and they investigated to see if it would be something to be dug. And I got to go on the last of their trips there in the late 70s, and I got down to the level of the breakdown where they were digging.
Okay.
It had flowed into the passage down there from above, and they had excavated this tunnel about 20 feet back into it and had been shoring it with 4x4 foot plywood sheets and 2x4s.
Wow.
Under the breakdown, and I didn't particularly see why they were digging that direction. It didn't look very good to be right under the middle of all this rubble. And they were telling me how strong the wind was, but when the wind blew in that rubble, that it was just literally roaring. And I wasn't sure I believed them, because when I was there with them, it wasn't doing anything, and I was skeptical. So that happened to be the last trip that they attempted digging there. They weren't making good progress. So several years went by, and I had still been doing things both at Carlsbad Cavern and in the canyon and then in Colorado. And this young man, Dave Allured, was one of the Colorado cavers, and I had initially been doing trips with him, and I had told him about this blowing lead in Lechuga Cave, and he was a good digger, and he was interested in restarting that dig.
Okay. So hang on, let me make sure I understand this. So you knew, and others knew, there was a lot of air moving through this rubble pile, and a fairly extensive 20-foot worth of work into it had not broken through. But the kind of question was the 20-foot worth of digging going in the right direction?
And the answer to that was no.
Oh.
And that turned out to be critical in the whole thing. Dave Allured was interested in restarting that, but he didn't know the park staff at all. So I volunteered to guide him to the cave. I was good friends at that time with the cave specialist at Carlsbad, Ron Kerbo, and we'd been doing things there under his supervision. So I told him I'd like to bring Dave Allured down there to Lechuga Cave and let him look and see if he was interested in digging. And
Donald, could you spell Ron's name and Dave's name, their last names, please?
Oh, yes. Dave is D-A-V-E A-L-L-U-R-E-D.
Thank you.
And Kerbo was R-O-N-A-L. Without a D, it's an unusual spelling, and the last name was Kerbo, K-E-R-B-O.
Thank you.
Now, Ron Kerbo is a man of legend himself that would be worth interviewing, but he may all have been already by people interested in that region. But anyway, so that was okay with Ron, so Dave Allured drove me down there, and I showed him the route to Lechuga Cave, and we dropped down into it on rope. And so at this point, it was a good day for the wind in the cave, and I got down to where the dig had been going in, and that had been completely caved in.
Oh, wow.
Decayed enough to become unstable, and the breakdown just smashed their tunnel, and you couldn't even see that there'd ever been a dig at that point.
Huh.
But the wind was roaring that day, and I could stand back 20 or 15 feet from that rubble slope of this 3-inch rock rubble talus and scree, and that far away it was just roaring, like literally noise that you could hear through there and blasting in your face several yards away. And that made a believer of me. And so we went back, and it was after hours, but I knew Ron Kerbo well enough to call on him at his home in the park. And I told him, yes, I think this is a good dig, and I recommended Dave as a responsible digger and caver. And I recommended that they permit Dave to restart the dig in North Virginia Cave. We went back to Colorado, and as I recall being told, Kerbo went to the rest of the park staff and debated this issue, whether this permit should be granted or not, and not all of them are in agreement with that. And I like to think that my recommendation to Ron Kerbo might have been critical in getting this approved.
Oh, cool.
And if they hadn't done that, then to this very day, history might have been different, and we might never have known that Wachigia Cave was a gigantic world-class feature.
Yeah.
But fortunately, 2 or 3 weeks passed, and they decided, yes, well, let them do this and see what happens. But about that same time, Dave Elliott and I had a falling out over certain policies. His cave politics were to ration new passage, a virgin passage, to new cavers so they could all get their fill of virgin cave. And my feeling was different. I felt that if you're going to survey these caves, that if you just let new young novices in, then you weren't going to get the best survey. They would all have to be trained and all to do it correctly. And if you wanted good, fast results, you should be having several experienced surveyors doing this, and he just wouldn't bend in that way, so he stopped inviting me on his Colorado trips, and my feelings were hurt.
Mm.
So I stopped trying to cave with Dave Alured, but there was this other guy, Rick Bridges, and also a caver named John Patterson in the Denver area, who were going on Dave Elliott's digs, and they kept at this until they'd made about 4 trips into there as of 1986. The fourth member of that team was, there's my old age kicking in again, but he's... Anyway, another element in this group. So there are 4 of them in the regular digging teams. And in May 1986, during this time, they had gone to the side of the passage where there was a descending hint of something dropping down along a joint. And the fractures are commonly controls for solution cave passage, and it looked to me like a better place to dig. And if so had it, it looked to Alured and crew than the original dig that the CRF people had been doing. So that's where they'd been working their way down. And they finally broke into passage down there. And when they did, the wind started blasting harder. It had been blowing well all along, sometimes out and sometimes in.
Huh.
And this time it blew some of the rocks back up at them and
wow.
then broke open into an enlarging void. So they were able to do a scouting trip down there, and it was a huge descending gallery going on down into the Permian limestone. And so at that point, the work had to stop, and some planning done by the park as to how to handle this. And Dave Alliard wanted to just keep it to the original teams and not let anyone else in. He was to be the sole manager of how the survey would be done, and he started to do that and didn't do it fast enough to suit Ron Curbo, and he wasn't being flexible about letting more people survey it and having more people come into the cave. And Ron Curbo wasn't happy ultimately after a few weeks of Dave being sole proprietor, and he decided to change the plan and offer first opportunities to the four people who had been on the breakthrough dig, but not to restrict the survey to them, and not to let Dave be the sole king over this project. And Dave wouldn't go along. He was rigid, and with him it was all or nothing. And he, rather than take a partial leadership role, he gave up the cave altogether.
Wow.
And let the other three take over. And it happened that I didn't have any beef with the other three. I actually got an opportunity to visit Lachia Cave just a month after the breakthrough, but not as part of that survey team, but as part of half a dozen people who were cave scientists and wanted to do a scientific recon into the cave to see if that would help with planning exploration and science there. And I got invited to be on that team. And
cool.
That happened a month after the NSS convention at Tularosa, New Mexico. And several well-established cave scientists were on that team. And we went to the cave and went down on the ropes to the depth of more than 600 feet, which was where the cave hit an intersection and broke into horizontal passages, the rest of which went south and had the strong wind coming through it. And I remember standing there where the rift dropped out at the bottom and feeling the wind going by my face in a gallery 20 feet high or 15 feet wide.
Wow.
And I realized this is heading toward the reef complex down through the back reef beds that it had been going down through. And if we can get down to the 900-foot level, we would be equal with the big room of Carlsbad Cavern, and there might be gigantic cave down that way. And
so what happened when you got to the 900-foot level?
Well, it did, in fact, fulfill my prediction at that level. That was heading away from Carlsbad Cavern in what we called the Great Western Borehole, which was, half a mile or more long and not as big, not as high and wide as the big room in Carlsbad, but much longer. And the entire cave, after we had found that the rift could be continued at the original level until it came to a three-way junction, and then branched out from that junction to the west and to the east and to the southwest into three different branches of Lechuga Cave, and it just kept going and going, and we established a whole complex project exploring it.
Wow.
Which went through political vicissitudes of different sorts.
What did Ron Curbo think about all this? Was he pretty happy the whole thing was going this way?
Well, as far as his administration problems went, that wasn't altogether good. The cavers, Dave Allured, had I mentioned how he and I.
Yeah, you guys had broken apart,
okay,
but Dave was working with three other people, Rick Bridges and Don Patterson and one other, Dave had just kind of walked away from the whole deal.
Right.
But as you guys started exploring and discovering this massive new world, you must have been, I'm assuming, reporting back to Ron,
and
I would assume that Ron was reporting back to his people in the Park Service.
Yes, and they were, of course, impressed with the way this was going, but also one of the leaders of the Lechuga Cave project that had taken over from Dave Allured, Rick Bridges, became overweening in his own glory, I guess you'd put it, and he wanted to keep the raw data, the original cave data from the survey, proprietary to himself.
What?
So he could sell it for money.
Wait a minute, he was in a national park.
Yes, he was in a national park. That's what all the rest of us realized. And we thought, Rick, you're not going to win this battle with the Park Service. But he exemplified something that is one of the few general principles that I think I've learned in life, living 84 years of it, was a great many of human and problems arise from not knowing where to stop.
Huh.
And Rick Bridges did not know where to stop about his own control of Lechuga Cave.
Huh.
So
what did the Park Service do?
They ultimately closed the project down for quite a while. I forget how long. And then came up the cavers, all that were at that time also working, trying to organize a project that would get back in and would provide the park with just what they wanted us to do. And so ultimately we came back in as a reorganized Lechuga project and resumed mapping the cave, but that had been a delay in our activities there.
When did the resuming of the mapping begin? Do you remember roughly the dates for that?
Not without reference to printed matter.
So the MPS came up with a better plan and then reopened it.
I think we sort of agreed on one.
Okay, so the MPS and the cavers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've got another thing going on right now, so I'm going to need to wrap this interview up, but when we come back, we can pick up what happened then, when y'all came back in for what would be the third go-round of Lechuguilla. Does that sound right?
Yes.
Okay. So this will conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Donald Davis. Today is February 3rd, 2023. It's Friday. My name is Tom Martin. And Donald, thank you so very, very much. This has been a very, very engaging, very fascinating interview.
I am.